Radio.
Guinness and God presents Professor Greg Craven, speaking on the topic, Living in Interesting Times, The Curse of the Modern Catholic. Guinness and God is brought to you by the Catholic Life Archdiocesan team of the Archdiocese of Canberra and Goulburn.
Thank you very much for that. All in favour of the Holy Spirit of enlightening me tonight. I have to warn you that it will probably be the first time that that's occurred when I've spoken. So far in the last 2 minutes, it seems to me I've managed two things. One is to break my watch, and the other was to come out of the bathroom with my fly under, both of which I apologise desperately to any of you who are offended. I'm sort of deeply conscious that tonight I really am breaking one of the rules of my life, which is to talk about something that could have anything to do with theology. I am a lawyer, not a theologian, and I've always believed that there are two things that vice chancellors and bishops should avoid at all costs. One is theology, and the other is maths. They can only get you into trouble. The only exception I make to that is that every now and again I will deliberately give the faintest hint that I might have some arcane piece of knowledge or one or the other. So maths, I'll do a quick piece of mental maths in the presence of my financial manager, and I think God, he might actually be able to add up. And in the context of theology, I will sit like the cretin I am and then say, do you think that some of the problems with General Belisarius and the Emperor Justinian was his temptations towards Arianism? Which is absolute nonsense. Belisarius was not an Arian, but it does make them wonder. And in the meantime, I just try and tell jokes against the Jesuits. Because I was born a Christian brother's boy. Who was taught by the Jesuits here? It's usually told them by the low sloping foreheads and tendencies towards heresy. You probably all have heard those good jokes, you know, the Dominican and the Jesuits, and they arguing whose order is greater. And the Dominican says, well, we are a lot better than you because of the purpose we're put for. And the Jesuit says, why? He said, well, we were put on earth to fight Albigensians. And the Jesuit said, yeah, we were put on here for the Counter-Reformation to fight Protestants. He said, proves my point. I said, why? He said, well, you see a lot of Protestants, there aren't many Albigensians around. I actually prefer my other son's joke, who actually points out that in one that he claims the order, some Jesuits are some of my best friends, I may say, like scorpions. He once said, if you look at some of the old translations of the Bible, you can actually prove, and I always say this to my friend Frank Brennan, the Jesuits are in fact satanic. And he said, how the hell can you say that? And he said, well, just look at the translation of the Bible. And Judas was constantly in the society of Jesus. So I've always tried to put that on. In terms of theology, therefore, I claim no expertise. I once had a senior member of staff say she would love to see my personal spirituality, and after a year the job said she'd revised her opinion, and on the whole she would rather that I did not publicly display it in future. So it's from that background I guess I come. That's probably fairly obvious in terms of the topic that I have chosen. It's what's called in the law, and I am a lawyer, a compendious topic. It allows someone who knows nothing about the subject upon which they've invited to speak to say anything that they actually like. And I deeply apologise if the topic sounds interesting. It wasn't meant to be and it won't be. It's an obvious reference to the old Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. I've always thought there was a great deal in that curse. The more interesting your times are, the more difficult they are likely to be. It also always reminds me of my good friend Bob French, the Chief Justice of the High Court, who he was then a federal court judge, and I was coming to be a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, and we got off the plane together, and he said, would you like a ride? I said, no, for a ride. And I said, what sort of republic would you like, Bob? He said, I'd like a direct election republic. And I said, you've got to be off your head. Why on earth would you want that? He said, oh, I think it'd be interesting. I pointed out to him that he and I, as constitutional lawyers, were sworn to make the Constitution as uninteresting and reliable as possible. But it's always stuck in my mind. So really what this is going to be is a series of sort of fairly random observations, and the only thing I can promise you is sincerity, because as a lawyer I can fake that. And everything I say is entirely personal, is not necessarily a view of the Australian Catholic University, nor indeed its Vice-Chancellor. In terms of interesting times and Catholicism, I think it's interesting because a lot of Catholics, probably most Catholics on a bad day, do have a sense of being a little beset these days. We face the challenges of secularism, atheism, we see falling attendances at Mass, and we see problems with priestly vocations, we're faced with the horror of child abuse, we see the fading of the orders and the change that that involves in the Church. You could occasionally be forgiven for getting just a little bit sort of least touch depressed. Now, I'm not saying there aren't wonderful moments as well. Having attended the canonisation of St. Mary MacKillop, yeah, we all know that the Church has its great moments. But I think sometimes there is a tendency for Catholics to look around them and say, look, you know, things are slightly crook in Tullaroog. I always think when people say that, that it's important to remember that the Church has always been beset. There has been no time when the Church has not been up against it. I was recently reading that book, and probably some of you are reading it, by John Julius Norwich about the popes. And you read about the early history of the papacy, and it reminds me of what my Anglican mother, who was a very good convert to Catholicism but had a somewhat idiosyncratic take on theology, used to say to me. She used to say that the absolute truth that the Catholic Church was divinely inspired was to look at the unbelievably low quality of its early popes and disasters, because no organisation that was not divinely inspired could possibly have survived with that motley crew in charge of it. And I think that there is a certain truth in that. And so in that context, where I think, you know, we could on occasions be forgiven for feeling we're up against it, that I'm making some of these comments. I've often been asked, you know, strange things about the Church. I remember, you know, many times on radio I've been asked, yeah, how on earth, you know, do you believe this stuff? I remember being at a meeting of the National Catholic Education and having drinks the night before with a number of bishops and having a number of very drunken ABC journalists come up to talk to me, who I happen to know. And we were talking away, and there was, I think, Richard Fielding or Five, there's a lovely guy, a very sort of thoughtful chap, and this very drunken guy came up and said, yes, but you can't possibly believe this stuff, can you? And I said, well, what stuff? And he said, this stuff about virgin births and gods and resurrection. I said, yes, yes, I believe it all absolutely and implicitly. And he just looked at me and fell onto the table. I thought was one of my great moments of rebuttal. But one of the things that I am occasionally asked is, what worries me most around Catholicism in the Church at the moment? There are lots of things that worry me. I have to say, one of the things that worries me most is the concept, not of something that's external, but something that's internal, and that's the concept of extremism within the Church. I mean, some of you probably remember the line from Late Yeats, the poem, "The best lack all conviction, while the worst are filled with passionate intensity." And then the line that goes on, "And what rough beast its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born." One of the things that worries me inside the Church is not passion and conviction, which are wonderful things, but enmity and rancour within the Church. It particularly worries me when I see opposite ends of the Church treating each other in a way and fighting with each other in a way that frankly seems to people outside the Church to be a scandal. Now, I always find left and right particularly bad and inadequate terms to describe the sort of thing I'm talking about. I have my own terms derived from the time when I was studying French history at Melbourne. I tend to refer to the Bourbons and Jacobins, and I'll try and explain what I mean by that. Neither of these groups I would describe as mainstream, but they are quite dangerous. The Bourbons, of course, were the French monarchy, the name of the last dynasty of France. It was said of the Bourbon princes when they returned after Napoleon that they had forgotten nothing and that they had learned nothing. And that's why I tend to think of some people in this context. And I think you may know some of the people I'm talking about. People who believe that all the bishops are either fools or cowards or both. That people who have an absolute belief in their own purity. people who would love to be able to retreat to some high and glorious hill of Catholicism upon which they could be, well, high and glorious. The people who I recall when I was in Perth and fighting very, very hard with the Catholic MPs to try and stop an absolutely dreadful statute permitting abortion helped us the day after we had persuaded Richard Court, the Premier of Western Australia, to oppose it by bringing out a full-page ad in the West Australia with a picture of him and his family with a caption like, "This is the Premier who wants to kill children." I find such people difficult. I find the Jacobins, who of course were the French radicals, equally difficult. They seem to agree on the Bourbons only one thing. It seems to be the only universal point of agreement at two extremes of the church, which is that the bishops are always wrong, stupid, cowardly, and evil, but for different reasons. That the bishops are in fact too conservative, that we should bring the church down, that we should start it again. And one of the peculiarities, I think, of that particular group is they insist that they are greatly wronged because they are greatly hated by their opponents, who they do not hate at all. It's just that the only things they ever say about them are hateful. And so the consequence is that from the outside, to a person who doesn't necessarily know the Catholic Church in its richness, what they tend to see is an obvious mutual loathing of different parts of the church. And it is, I think, in the technical theological sense, a scandal to non-believers. I have a dear Jewish friend who is a professor of law at Monash University, and he says, "I will believe you Catholics and Christians about love the day you start loving each other, let alone the day you start loving them." And that worries me. It worries me either of those tendencies taken to their extreme. The idea that we could, for example, seriously say that our mission as a church is to retreat, that our role as a church is to be a church of the mountain but not of the plain, of the few but not of the many. Because it seems to me that that is a recipe and that is an injunction to lose nobly. Now, there are times when one can afford to lose. I can remember the day that Andrew Rock rang me up and said, "Will you come out in support of the Republic?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Hang on, you do know we're going to be done like a dinner, don't you?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Then why do you want to be associate?" I said, "I'm Irish. The only thing better than a noble cause won is the noble cause lost." Religion is a little too important to take that view of. And frankly, however seductive the idea may be, I really don't see myself as being part of a loser religion. I don't think that Christ came on this world to lose, that Christ came on this world to win, no matter how seductive that may appear to some people. And I have to say I would warmly associate myself with the views of George Cardinal Pell that there is much to be said for mass Christianity. And so I find that tendency in the church deeply troubling. I find it as troubling as that opposite tendency that I've seen. The refusal in that group to, I think, see the fundamental similarity between themselves and their opponents. A fundamental similarity which to me lies in a basic lack of charity. A basic lack of charity and love, which I find deeply depressing. In a group in this case, which in an opposite way knows everything that it is against, but very little for which it actually is for. I always remember there's one great example of that. This is a sort of moment of personal irritation and bitterness. When we had to put a statue of Mary MacKillop up on the North Sydney campus, we were very careful about how you do it. And you all know the standard picture of Mary MacKillop. She is this scrapping 40-year-old nun with eyes the size of saucers and sort of shoulders the size of a cartwheel. Looks as if she could take on anything, and that's a pretty accurate representation. But when Mary MacKillop died next to our North Sydney campus, that isn't what she was like. She was an old lady who suffered a stroke, who lived her life in what the Victorians would have called a bath chair, and her joy was to sit there with one arm on her rosary beads praying to her God, and the other arm on her little dog, an Australian terrier called Bobs. And that's how she met God, and that's how she lived near a campus, and that's how we chose to depict her. And yet I'll never forget reading on a website by one of the priests of the Archdiocese of Sydney how typically wicked and evil and conservative this was, because this clearly was a plot to make Mary MacKillop, as a woman, look weak, powerless and pathetic compared to the virile statue of Pope John Paul II on the steps of St Mary's Cathedral. And I don't know what I was more offended by, the lack of charity in it, or the deep misunderstanding of the power of old women in the tradition of the Catholic Church, and particularly the Irish Church. So that lack of charity deeply worries me. It also worries me about sometimes what that type of view posits about what it is to be a Catholic, and I'll return to that. See, my own view of this, which is, and I have already confessed myself as a theological idiot, so I can certainly claim the defence of invincible ignorance, if I ever have to on this one, is that if you want to put this in terms of left and right, and if we say that God is at the centre of our world, which we do, and which he is, then it seems to me that God is a centrist, by definition, rather than left or right wing. He is, in fact, if I may modestly say, a sort of moderate conservative like me. Sort of a Peter Costello with a better smile. Or Kim Beazley but a bit more of a bastard. Somewhere firmly smack bang dead centre and not out to one of the extremes. And when I think of my God and my church, I have to say I think of that sort of centrist and urbane and civilised God, all of which strike me as qualities that come from the heart of God rather than going to the heart of God. And certainly never shrill, never nasty, never petty, and never, ever, ever the sort of loser that you would not want to find yourself standing next to in a pub like this. Now, I don't mean by that that God is not determined and does not have determined views. I think everything we know about God suggests that God is quite clear on a whole range of interesting things. And both testaments will tell us that God is prepared to stand for those things. So, I mean, I utterly reject and would not want to be understood as suggesting for a moment that I have any tendencies towards the nothing central brand of Catholicism that occasionally gets out there. That, well, you know, everything is negotiable. You know, the Pope is a chip on the board. The Eucharist really can be understood in many, many thousands of ways. The resurrection may or may not have happened and all of those sort of things. Everything is negotiable. No. It seems to me that Catholicism has, by definition, a centre, it has a periphery, it has a middle. It often strikes me with some of my friends who take that particular view of Catholicism that it's a view that could not be taken of any other phenomenon in the world. If you went into a party and said, "Hello, I'm Greg, I'm a Green," and you said, "Wow, you know, what do you believe in?" And you said, "Logging, nuclear power, I absolutely don't believe in climate change, I'll have nothing to do with it, and I think Bob Brown is a menace to society," any rational person would say to you, "Mate, take your hand off it. Whatever else you are not a Green, because you don't believe in any of the things that characteristically define a Green." I think that's true of religion too. There is a point at which one can honestly and particularly dissent from a particular view, but at that point one passes outside that view rather than into a different form of view. And that doesn't mean that there aren't issues upon which there can be many different shades of meaning and discussion and debate. We rejoice in a church that can do that. But it does mean that there is a finite position. And having said that, though, to then go towards the other end of it, there are means by which that position can be held that are admissible and means that are inadmissible. In other words, my view would be that while there is an absolute and definite and finite truth, and that one must hold to that finite truth, one holds with determination and humour and civilisation, and one fights when one must, and one fights hard, but one does not spit. And it does seem to me that in our modern day, there is a little too much spitting going on. I do find it funny, and you know, one must take these moments of humour, and I've said this occasionally before, the new definition of modern apologetics. I mean, most of you looking around you would be far too young to know what Catholic apologetics were. Some of you would be so old you've clearly forgotten. I'm in the middle. I can remember the joke was that a Catholic apologist was someone who could defend the faith. The new joke is that a Catholic apologist is someone who apologises for being a Catholic. One of the things I always find hilarious in the media is that if you look for a Catholic spokesperson, 9 times out of 10, that person can be someone who can be absolutely relied upon to say, the church is completely wrong on this, and this person is a Catholic spokesperson. It's very interesting to find other organisations of whom you can actually say that that tends to happen. I can only think of one other, and that's the Australian Liberal Party. I mean, how with the Australian Liberal Party, typically you'll get either Malcolm Fraser or John Hewson coming on to say that every single leader of the Liberal Party since then has been stark raving mad. That's the only other organisation I can find. I'm still trying to find the point of commonality, but it is quite funny, and I'll come back to a couple of things like that too. I think one thing we do have to worry about, and I think it's one of the explanations for some of the more extreme positions that I've noticed, is something deeply troubling, and that is that the Australian Catholic Church hasn't really developed recently a public intellectual strand that can be used in public debate strongly, rationally and attractively to defend Catholic positions. And if you go through lists of public intellectuals, and newspapers will occasionally publish them, and may I just confess briefly to a small peccadillo, which is a passionate, deep and abiding love for Maxine McHugh, who when they once asked, I think, 40 prominent Australians to name public intellectuals, was the only one been named me, and I refuse to hear a word against that. About 10 of the bastards named my brother Peter, but she was the only one to have the taste to name me. Very few of those people are Catholics, and of them, even fewer are people who are publicly intellectual about Catholicism. They're either publicly intellectual about something else, or perhaps they're Catholically apologetic in the way I've suggested. And I think that is the difficulty for the church, because you can't reasonably expect the bishops to carry the weight of every single public controversy that's out there. Believe it or not, bishops are not actually chosen by the Holy Father on their media capacity. You know, the Holy Spirit does not descend upon them and say, here are the keys to Kerry O'Brien. That is not how it works. And it always interests me to watch how much people expect and how unreasonable their expectations are. I can remember giving advice to an archbishop who was in the process of almost being summoned before a parliamentary committee. He'd been invited, that's what they call it, to give evidence. And he was saying, well, that can't be that dangerous, can it? And I said, yes, that can be very, very, very dangerous, Your Grace. He said, but all I have to do is get up and read a statement on this, and it'll be fine. I said, yes, you'll get up, you'll read your statement on this, and then every nutcase from the left of the ALP of the relevant state will stand up, and every Green, and will take this opportunity to cross-examine the Archbishop of blank on every gripe they have ever had to do with anything in the Catholic Church. And there was silence. And His Grace said, well, what are we to do? And I said, Your Grace, what we do is we put up someone who has no public name, of whom they have never heard, and who is completely expendable, who no one will be interested in talking to. And one of the junior bishops said, who's that? And I smiled at him. And he did a spiffing job. And he was out of there in about 5 minutes. Now, it seems to me that, you know, remember the old thing about scripture, you're meant to be as cunning as serpents and as gentle as doves, not as stupid as doves and as nasty as serpents. But we actually have to get quite good at those things. We need to understand it. I also think, and this is a personal view, and it comes partly from my age, that a lot of the bitter debate in the church actually is rather generational rather than conceptual or theological. I think a lot of the debate comes between people for whom Vatican II was either the greatest moment of their lives and should have gone even further and greater in so many ways, or people for whom it was a terrible and disastrous thing and they were deeply involved and it should be wound back and stopped. And again, there are those of you here who would have a very, very clear memory of Vatican II and all of those things, and there would be people who, I suspect, take both of those views, sometimes both on different bits at the same time. There would be those of you to whom it literally is history. I'm in a very, very odd position on this because I am 53 years old. I was born in 1958. I'm in a peculiar generation that doesn't actually remember the Latin Mass, even though it was the Mass that I was taken to as a young child. I don't remember the Mass in Latin. I remember the prayer books in Latin, but they were just words, much prettier words with lots of colours, but I have no personal memory of them. And I don't remember Vatican II, except as a series of changes, the reasons for which I neither knew nor was I consulted about. They just happened. So I'm in that sort of middle generation. My deepest memory, which I suspect probably determines various sort of scarred moments of my life, was in 1968. So we're sort of getting towards the end of the beginning. And I was taught by the presentation nuns. And the presentation nuns at St. Leonard's Glen Waverley, as a prize, you did something really good. They used to give you out holy cards. Now, looking back on it, they were pretty lurid holy cards, and I don't think they ever attained any great degree of art. But for someone like me, who was neither clever nor particularly good, they were objects of great attainment, because my sister had hundreds of the bloody things. And I only ever got one in 6 years, and it was taken off me the same day. Not even for having done something wrong, just for having been stupid. And one day in 1968, I can still remember this little girl coming in. It was a cold day, it was raining outside, screaming into the classroom. And we had this huge school incinerator, I'm sure you always remember them, and she said, "They're burning the holy cards." And we all raced out, and because it was windy, these holy cards were on fire, and they were shooting up this 8-foot chimney and showering us with these burning St. Veronicas, which we were frantically trying to save and put out, because we'd always been told that these things were marks of goodness. Now, that's sort of the memory that I have of the liveliness, but also the sort of sheer cack-handedness of some of the changes around that time. And it sort of neither recommends nor withdraws it from me. But it's that sort of odd, empathetic thing. I have to say, it's still my vision of hell, burning holy cards around me. And I know when I go there, that's what I'll be greeted with. Somebody throwing, probably St. Augustine, he's the sort of person to do that. I think one of the things that has done, though, is it's had some remarkable effects on debates, which has been to freeze them in the early 1970s, so that a lot of people whose ideas of what was a good idea or a bad idea was formed in the 1970s are still there. One of the things that struck me is liturgy. I think a lot of liturgy and a lot of hymns in particular from the 1970s are still there for no other reason than they were there in the 1970s, and that's when a lot of us were formed. The truth is that there are some wonderful things from the 1970s and some really terrible things from the 1970s. Mission Brown paint was from the 1970s. Orange linoleum was from the 1970s. Hymns with the sacred name of God in Hebrew from the 1970s. None of them are desirable just because they're from the 1970s. And I'm always terribly nervous of people who can claim a deep contemporary empathy with youth on the basis that they were 21 in 1967. It doesn't seem to me they're particularly strong credentials. It always strikes me as much more complicated that, for example, I have four children, each more horrible than my last. The first of whom was born in 1982. The last was born in 1993. They are all still mass-going Catholics, and they are distinctly different between the two born in 82 and 83 and the ones born in 90 and 93 in the way that they relate to Catholic issues around them. It's quite odd. Now, if there's that sort of difference between them, you can imagine the sort of difference between them and me, and you can imagine the difference as they go on. I don't think the 1970s is necessarily automatically appealing to youth any more than I think the 1490s is necessarily automatically appealing to youth. I do think, interestingly, that the one thing that I've noticed in the change between the spirituality of my youth and the spirituality of some of your youth is the vastly greater value placed on mystery among young people. I have noticed that young people deeply value the mysterious in life, and I think one of the difficulties is that there's nothing particularly mysterious about orange linoleum and brown paint. It can be quite hard to adapt that. I actually think that sense of mystery explains a lot of what is explained today as conservatism in younger Catholics. And I don't think it's just in the church. I mean, the fact that you can see the rise of science fiction and fantasy novels and everything from paganism to environmentalism and so on and so forth is part of a tendency which also plays out, but in a much more sublime way, I think, in the context of worship. And I suspect as the world becomes more uncontrollable and more frightening, which it is, people will look more and more and more for that sense of sacred and mystery in religion, not less. And I think that will have implications. I also think some of the fad phrases are quite weak in explaining contemporary realities, and we have to reassess them. For example, I mean, all of us at different points, I suspect, have occasionally said things about consumer Catholicism, you know, the idea that you can pick the bits you like and you don't like the other bits. I've had a number of conversations with a number of bishops about World Youth Day, and I've said one of the things that fascinated me about World Youth Day was the extent to which he suggested that that phenomenon is so much more complex than we might think. So, for example, at World Youth Day, I remember seeing students who I actually knew, for whose alcoholic habits I would not vouch, for whose sexual restraint I would not care to undergo any form of financial guarantee, for whose unfamiliarity with forbidden substances I would not be prepared to take an oath, but fall on their knees in prayer for 20 minutes in the mud at Randwick at the exposition of the Blessed Sacrament. Now, that is not explicable in terms of consumer Catholicism, because you've just chosen a rotten item from the menu if the only thing you care about is some shallow form of gratification. So I think both sides of the various debates we have a lot to learn. I also think that relatively simplistic view affects a number of things. This is the only thing I will venture any sort of utterly unformed theological opinion on. And I think it was Calvin Coolidge. It was Coolidge, the famously taciturn president who came home from church and they said, "What was the sermon about?" And he said, "Sin." And they said, "Oh, what did the pastor say?" And he said, "He was against it." So the only topic I'll actually venture an opinion on is sin. So it always struck me that, you know, within our own idea of sin, there are really two approaches to one's own failings. One is to sort of admit that they're there and they're wrong and they're bad and sort of try and repent for them. The other extreme is to try and define them away. Either they're there but there's nothing wrong with them, or I can't help it, which comes down to the same thing. Now, I always see this in a sort of a lawyer's point of view. I mean, lawyers, what we really worry about is reform and recidivism. The problem is, while some people can reform themselves from crime, we know that we are all recidivists. That no matter what our sins are, we're all going to commit them again by likelihood. We will try, but the potential for 100% reform in a real world is hard. It does seem to me that there is a modern tendency to try and solve that paradox by defining it out of existence, by saying either that nothing is wrong or that we're not responsible for anything and that therefore we can manage it in that way. And you can understand the attractions of that. I think if we're honest with ourselves, most of us will have attractions to that form of thinking from time to time. The question, of course, is if that's right, what exactly does religion have to offer? What does Christianity have to offer? What does Catholicism have to offer? And what does redemption have to offer? In other words, if I was to make the first point, what is the value add of religion in that type of context, except a sort of punching bag God who at the end of the day really doesn't care? And is that an attractive option to be offering anybody if you're a person looking for gold, if you're a god looking for someone? It also seems to me that that type of idea ultimately is disabling, because what it does is it makes it impossible to distinguish in traditional Catholic terms between the sin that we detest and the sinner whom we love. If the sin and the sinner are inextricable and each indistinguishably to be valued in exactly the same way and not to be responsible for anything that happens or attributable in any possible connection, then how can one draw the distinction between saying what you have done is wrong and you should not do it, but nevertheless you as a person remain the creature of God and I value you? And if you can't draw that distinction, is it any great surprise that we have such difficulty communicating to people about the great moral issues of our times? Things like abortion and euthanasia and same-sex marriage, all of which occur in circumstances of great hurt and great difficulty, where it's so easy to find a solution like that that is not a solution. I mean, my own theory of this, to the extent that I have a theory, going back to my sort of centrist, somewhat Kim Measley-like devotional theories, is really that it is about acknowledging sin and acknowledging that it's wrong and trying and failing, and then at that point throwing oneself upon the boundless love of God and the boundless weakness of oneself, but certainly not in some sort of surrogate of pride. Now that comes far too close to theology for me, so I shall skip off onto three quite practical things by way of conclusion that I really see as challenges. I see one great challenge for us as being in the current laicization of the church. We all know what's happening. We're seeing, if you like, the twilight of so many orders. And what are some of the challenges that face us with that? I think one of the great challenges we desperately face is health. Because as we all know, with education, the bishops have always been desperately interested in education. It's always been a fundamental and primary work. And what do? With health, we leave it to the sisters. What happens when the sisters are gone? And it seems to me that in many ways we are doing much better with education in the sense of developing governance systems and developing ideas perhaps than in other areas which have always been in a position where it has been possible to leave them in other ways. A second issue I see is around formation. We know how hard we're trying to help in education and in social services to form people so that we maintain the charism that maintains the works. Yet how easy is that going to be? And how easy is it to fall into a sort of gestural Catholicism so that you end up with, instead of the authentic charism of an order behind health or education, from an idea by the presentation nuns, from an idea by Jesus Christ, a sort of Hollywood adaptation. What are the necessary and sufficient conditions of the heroic work that I know so many, all of you, are trying to do to maintain that reality of not just good works, but good Catholic works? And I think, I hate to say this, but it's something we are only just beginning to taste that cup. And the third thing I'd say, this is a very much a lawyer's type of point, is what is the governance you have to put around that? Because I can tell you one thing I've learned about constitutions, two things. One is governance is programmed to fail. By and large, the one thing I know about constitutions is you write 100 constitutions for 100 countries, 99 will be dead within 10 years. Governance is hard work. Second thing you know is you don't leave it till the last minute. Guess what? By and large, we've left it to the last minute. And there are many dangers in that. May I outline just one? There is a vast difference between a bureaucracy and a charism, between a bureaucrat and an order. There is a great danger that as we move to governance systems to replace charism, we move to a bureaucracy. And one of the great advantages of the Catholic Church, it seems to be, in its works, has been its individuality, its richness, and its diversity. And if we lose that, we are, to use the immortal Latin phrase of Ovid, stuffed. I always remember a minister of the crown in the right of the Commonwealth saying, why is it, do you think, that the value of the building education revolution of the Gillard-Rudd government for every dollar in a Catholic school in Victoria to us seems to be about $2.46, and in a state school in New South Wales is 34 cents. It isn't that you are better people than they. And I said, no, it's because each of our schools is different. Each has a community, each is accountable to its community, each is a work of a parish, and a parish is a real thing, and that's how you get difference and value. Bureaucracies don't give that. How do we have governance with faith but without bureaucracy? Second thing I'd say is, you'd expect me to say something about Catholic universities. I won't say much, but I will say this. I mean, one of the questions, of course, is why do you need Catholic universities? I think the need for Catholic public intellectuals is one. But I also think the pervasive secularity of secular universities is another. I mean, I went to the University of Melbourne. I taught there for 12 years. I was educated there for 7 years. I married my wife while I was a fourth-year student at the University of Melbourne. I love the University of Melbourne. I had lunch with the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Melbourne today. But to pretend that the University of Melbourne then or now is even faintly sympathetic to Christian ideas is to seriously delude oneself. And in fact, every university has its own truth. The Australian Catholic University has its own truth. It is a very, very different truth to that of a liberal secular university, which I think all too often are a good deal more secular than they are liberal when it comes to tolerance of religious ideas. I always remember, and I recount this story in English, we were doing the poem Holy Thursday by William Blake, the great evangelical Christian, and my Marxist tutor was leading the tube through and saying, what if this poem was about? And I was sitting there saying, I am not going to say anything. I am not going to say anything. And we did every possible reading, deconstructionalist, post-deconstructionalist, the Geelong Football Club deconstructionalist. And finally, so I just couldn't take it anymore, and I said, look, it's Holy Thursday. He's talking about these children in an orphanage. He's referring to them as lambs. Holy Thursday was the day that the lamb was betrayed. Could it possibly have something to do with this? And he said, we'll have none of this doctrinaire Christianity in this church. That's one of the reasons we need Catholic universities. I think the challenge, I guess, is it's not good enough to be Catholic. You actually have to be good. Having a bad Catholic university is worse than having no Catholic university, because it simply becomes a calumny on the very notion of Catholic universities. That's why it's so vital that Catholic universities just don't teach, they research. They don't just search, they are out there and they speak. And it's why their education has to be pervasively Catholic. There should be a value-added difference in Catholic literature than there is in secular literature, in the same way as the University of Melbourne would say there's something about Melbourne literature that's different to Sydney. And I do think we have to deal with that problem. And, you know, as a Catholic vice chancellor, I get with it all the day. The idea of Catholics who, at this stage of their development and their position in society, frankly, don't want to be a member of any club that's prepared to have them as a Catholic. That, you know, just as we've moved past sending our boys to Riverview and we now send them to St. Scott's, we certainly wouldn't want to send our boys or girls to ACU when we could send them to nice, respectable Catholic universities like the Australian National University or Sydney. Many and varied challenges. And I suppose the other thing I'll just briefly mention is, and this is one of the things that I think is quite fascinating about our age and is a challenge, is that why on earth have we been so privileged as to see the rise of militant atheism, which is particularly anti-Catholic? I mean, I remember writing an article about this on The Age. It was actually very funny. The Age rang me up to ask me to write an article attacking militant atheism. That's how desperate The Age was about how its opinion pages were going. And some of you might remember a person, Catherine Devine, who was the maniac, I remember I get a surname, was writing some particularly sort of good stuff. One of the things I said was the traditional atheist was a chap called Norm. He used to hand out pamphlets on Little Collins Street. And one was about nudism and the benefits of the sun, and the other was about the joys of atheism. He was quite a nice chap. but he certainly didn't want to impress himself on them. Suddenly we have the rise of an atheism that's incredibly confident, and it very, very determined, and very, very out there. Now, I quite obliviously wrote an article about atheism. I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll be funny. You know, atheists tend to think they're pretty funny. They've got lots of jokes about everything from the Virgin Mary to the preserved head of St. Jude. I'll have a laugh about atheism. Great thing about writing, and some of you may occasionally write for newspapers, is that almost no one ever reads it. There's almost never a reaction. In 30 years of writing for just about every newspaper in this country, I've had two death threats in my life. One was over the Republic, which at the end of the day, I mean, really isn't worth killing anyone for on any analysis on either side of the debate. And one was when I defended a Geelong footballer called Gary Hockey and accidentally said something negative about the Hawthorn Football Club. And we actually had to close down the University of Melbourne Law School for 3 hours while they searched for a crazed Hawthorn sport. So I'm used to getting no reaction at all to anything I write. I got 333 comments on the Age website, and don't think I didn't notice that's exactly half of 666. 333 nutcases wrote in. I think three of them defended me, and I think 27 accused me of having sexual relations with altar boys. And I remember saying to the editor, the opinion editor of the Age, is every single one of your readers a Catholic hating atheist? And her immortal response was, I believe our circulation figures speak for themselves. It is a remarkable reality that you have this change, I think, where it's both much more confident, much more militant, and much more organised. And that's why you often get people saying that atheism today starts to resemble a religion. It starts to have high priests, it starts to have a programme, it starts to be sort of quite messianic. It is interesting to wonder two things. Why is that happening now? And why is it particularly hostile perhaps to Catholicism rather than other branches of religion? I can only offer two theories about that. I think one of the reasons that it's so intense now is because it's this extraordinary praxis in its own mind of perceived almost success and utter fail. On the one hand, in the Western heartland of Christianity, it really feels it's that close, just that close. And at the same time, looking at revival of religion around the world, at exactly the same moment, it all looks as if it's going to slip away into something even worse. And that's the sort of thing that makes you very, very, very nervous and extremely hysterical. Why the particular problem with Catholics? Because I think in the West, if you are a sincere atheist who really doesn't like people who are religious, then Catholicism is probably the one you'd like to take out, because with all of our difficulties, we're probably still pretty lively. And one of the really funny things about atheists, and I'm talking about this particular type of atheist, because some of my best friends and relatives are atheists, is in fact that they think that they're hysterically funny. And that means two things. One is there's nothing terribly funny about evangelical Christians. They don't tend to think atheists are still a person that evangelicals have a sense of humour. And Catholics, there are an awful lot of jokes you can tell about us. We're a pretty rich, funny sort of religion, which we rejoice in. And that sort of thing is enormously important. That's why I always think the greatest cure to atheism, I used to think, the greatest cure to militant atheism was humour. I have now discovered that atheists have no sense of humour if it's actually used about atheism. So I've sworn off humour on atheism. So those are the thoughts I have. I hope I have at no point actually strayed onto anything that resembled theology, or at least correct theology. I plan for my next talk to be on higher mathematics. I thank you all for your attention. I think this is a wonderful initiative. I think it's splendid it happens in Canberra. I've always said to our campuses in Sydney and Melbourne, this is exactly the sort of thing that we should be doing, and it hasn't happened yet. So this is perhaps, if not the one thing, then at least one thing, that Canberra is well in advance of the rest of the Federation. So thank you very much.
That was Professor Greg Craven on Living in Interesting Times, The Curse of the Modern Catholic. Guinness and God is presented once a month at King O'Malley's Pub in Canberra. And for more, visit cradio.org.au.